So, why should we care what happens to people who won't be born until after all of us are long gone? Why should we care whether there are any people who are born after we are long gone? Should the prospect of human extinction by the end of this century or the next one trouble us? And if so, why? There's an answer to these questions that's implicit in much of the contemporary philosophical literature dealing with our responsibilities to future generations. The answer is that we have reasons of beneficence to care about the existence of future generations and about the quality of life they will enjoy. However, I'm not persuaded that considerations of beneficence have either as much normative authority or as much motivational force as many writers about future generations appear to believe. In this lecture, I'll suggest that, quite apart from considerations of beneficence, we have reasons of at least four different kinds to try to ensure the survival and flourishing of those who come after us. When I say that we have reasons of these kinds, I don't mean that everyone does, only that many people do. My aim is not to establish that all rational agents must recognize these reasons. For my purposes, the fact that many people have these reasons is sufficient. At a practical level, it expands the collective repertoire of reasons that may be drawn upon when trying to motivate action aimed at ensuring the survival and flourishing of our successors. And at a theoretical level, it enriches our understanding of the evaluative resources available to us as we contemplate the significance for us of life in the future after we are gone. In developing my suggestion, I'll build on some of the ideas I discussed in my book, Death and the Afterlife. The central theme of that book is that our capacity to find value in our activities here and now is more dependent than we realize on the implicit assumption that human life will continue long after we ourselves have died. Many of the activities that we now find it worthwhile to engage in would lose much of their point and would seem to us much less valuable if we thought that human life was about to come to an end. Indeed, my conjecture is that the prospect of humanity's imminent extinction would be viewed by many people as catastrophic, even if it would be accomplished in a way that did not reduce the lifespan of anyone who was already alive. In order to illustrate these ideas, I described a scenario derived from P.D. James's novel, The Children of Men, in which the human race as a whole has become infertile for unknown reasons. No birth has occurred in over 25 years, and the extinction of the human race is imminent as an aging population gradually but steadily fades away. It's no part of this scenario that any living person has to die prematurely. Instead, human beings are simply fading from the scene, week by week, month by month, year by year. How would we react if we found ourselves living under these conditions? My conjecture, which I hope people who think carefully about the question will find plausible, is that most of us would find the prospect of humanity's imminent extinction unbearably depressing. This doesn't mean merely that we would feel sad or unhappy or sorrowful. At least as significant is the fact that many of the activities that we previously regarded as worthwhile would no longer seem to us as appealing. Some of those activities would seem completely pointless. This means that our capacity to find value in our activities would be seriously eroded. Nor is it clear that we would be systematically mistaken in reacting in these ways. These reactions may instead teach us something unexpected. They may teach us that the value of many of our activities depends, to a degree that we rarely recognize, on the implicit assumption that human life will persist long after we ourselves are gone. Now, the tendency of this line of thought, it may seem, is to suggest that we have self-interested reasons to ensure humanity's survival. We need future generations to survive in order that we ourselves can lead what I call value-laden lives, lives structured by wholehearted engagement in valued activities. If so, then it follows on this interpretation of the argument that our reasons for trying to ensure the survival of future generations are self-interested reasons that derive ultimately from our concern for ourselves. In Death and the Afterlife, I tacitly encouraged this interpretation, even though I explicitly disavowed it. I tacitly encouraged it because I maintained that there's a specific sense in which the survival of humanity after our own deaths matters more to us than our personal survival. The point was that, however terrified we may be at the prospect of our own deaths, the prospect of humanity's imminent extinction would actually do more to undermine our capacity here and now to find value in our activities. This may naturally be taken to mean that the reason we need humanity to survive is in order to fulfill our own interest in leading valuable lives. At the same time, I explicitly disavowed this interpretation. I claimed that the fact that the prospect of humanity's extinction would be so devastating for us reveals some limits to our egoism, because it reveals the extent to which we're dependent on the survival of others, indeed, on the survival of as yet non-existent strangers, in order to find value in our own lives. But without denying this point about our dependence on others, some readers have continued to feel that, insofar as this line of thought shows that we have reasons for seeking to ensure the survival of humanity, those reasons are nevertheless self-interested ones, because they have their source in our concern to lead valuable lives ourselves. Humanity's survival matters to us only insofar as our belief in it is a precondition of our finding value in our own projects and goals. Yet from the fact that the survival of others matters more to us than our personal survival, in the sense that we depend more on the survival of others in order to lead value-laden lives, it doesn't follow that the survival of others matters to us only or primarily for that reason. It doesn't follow, nor do I believe it is true. If the human race were faced with imminent extinction through, for example, universal infertility, then, as I've said, many people would view this as a terrible catastrophe. They would find it emotionally devastating. The prospect of humanity's imminent disappearance would lead to widespread grief, gloom, and depression. The fact that people would react this way shows not that they think humanity's disappearance would be a setback to their interests, but rather that the survival of humanity matters to them in its own right. Indeed, it's precisely because humanity's survival matters to them in its own right that its disappearance would be a setback to their interests. It's true, of course, that the disappearance of humanity would make certain activities pointless, and so it would be instrumentally irrational for people to continue to engage in them. Why bother trying to find a cure for cancer, or to enhance the seismic safety of bridges, or to improve the quality of early childhood education, if there will be no people around to benefit from one's efforts? Since, under present conditions, the people engaged in these activities have an interest in continuing to engage in them, the disappearance of humanity would indeed be a setback to those people's interests. But what's important to notice is this: the fact that people think it antecedently worthwhile to engage in such activities, so that their interests eventually become bound up with the success of those activities, reveals that what happens to future generations already matters to them. They believe it's worthwhile devoting their lives to activities whose greatest benefits may not be realized until after they're gone. If they didn't believe that, they would not choose to engage in such activities in the first place, and their interests would not come to be defined by them. More generally, many of our activities, whether or not they have the goal-oriented character of cancer research or seismic safety efforts, take for granted the importance to us of future generations. The primary reason why the prospect of humanity's disappearance would be devastating to those engaged in such activities is not that it would make the activities seem pointless. The activities only make sense in the first place on the assumption that future generations matter to us, and it's because their survival matters to us that the prospect of imminent extinction would be devastating. Of course, since the activities would be rendered pointless, and since it's in our interest to engage in worthwhile activities, it follows that we do have an interest in humanity's survival. But that's not the primary reason why we should concern ourselves with humanity's survival. The primary reason is that it matters to us in its own right, whether we recognize it or not. The appeal to our interests presupposes this prior reason. If the survival of human beings did not already matter to us, we would not have the same interest in trying to ensure it. In short, we have an interest in their survival because they matter to us. They do not matter to us because we have an interest in their survival. Now, granted, this may not be true of everyone. Suppose that my project is to build large monuments to myself, solely in order that future generations of human beings will know who I was and think about me from time to time. Then a belief that humanity will survive is necessary in order for me to find value in my project, and the imminent extinction of the human race would deprive the project of its point. But it's not clear that humanity's survival matters to me in any other way. Just as the self-interested interpretation insists, it matters to me only insofar as it's a precondition for finding value in my project. But this, I hope you'll agree, is an unusual case. For most people who wish to be remembered by future generations, the wish is not simply to be remembered, but to be remembered because one has done something worthy of recognition and admiration. The question, then, is what activities or accomplishments these people regard as worthy of admiration, and how the perceived worth of those activities and accomplishments would itself be affected by the imminent extinction of humanity. More importantly, most people who regard their activities as worthwhile do not hope or expect that they will be remembered by future generations at all. Yet many of them would nevertheless feel that their activities were no longer worth pursuing, or that they were less worth pursuing if humanity's disappearance were imminent. Or so I've maintained. It may seem that my argument has an elitist character, because only those who are relatively affluent and well-educated can devote themselves to activities whose value depends on the assumption that humanity will survive. Most people don't have the luxury of devoting themselves to such activities. They must work at unrewarding jobs, if they can find them, simply so that they themselves can survive. The value of these unrewarding activities would not be undermined by the prospect of humanity's disappearance. But rather than refuting my argument, this consideration seems to me to reinforce it. It's true that relatively few people have the luxury of earning their living by engaging in activities they find independently rewarding. It's a privilege to be able to support oneself as a scientist or an artist or an athlete or an intellectual. But the fact that many people must work at unrewarding activities in order to survive, activities they do not independently value, tells us nothing about the character of the activities people do value or find rewarding. In particular, it does not show that the survival of future generations matters only to the rich or the privileged. It shows only that the rich and the privileged are more likely to be able to devote their lives to independently valuable activities. And it's only when our activities reflect our values that they are good indicators of what matters to us. We should find it striking that the more people have the resources that make it possible for them to choose rewarding activities to which to devote themselves, the more they gravitate toward endeavors that depend for their point on the assumption that humanity will persist. The upshot is that in addition to any reasons of beneficence we may have, we also have reasons of two further kinds to attach significance to the fate of future generations. The first, which we may call reasons of concern, rests on the fact that their fate matters to us in its own right, while the second, which we may call reasons of interest, appeal to our own interest in leading lives engaged in worthwhile activities. These two categories of reason are conceptually independent, but in fact, it's only because future generations matter to us in their own right that we have an interest in their survival. There's a lot packed into the thought that the survival of humanity or of future generations matters to us. As I said in yesterday's lecture, the idea of future generations is the idea of a succession of cohorts, each related to its predecessors and successors, both temporally and causally, extending from now into the future. Insofar as future generations matter to us, and insofar as we care about the survival of humanity, what matters to us is that the causal and temporal chain of generations should continue. Nor are we concerned solely with humanity's bare survival. Rather, we want future generations to survive under conditions conducive to their flourishing. This is not a concern about the welfare of future people considered as an unstructured group. What we are concerned about is the extension of the chain of human generations through time. Since the chain of generations is constituted ultimately by chains of individual descent, you might think that any concern we have for the former must reduce to a concern for some instances of the latter. You might think, for example, that our concern for future generations consists in a concern that we ourselves should have children, who in turn have children, and so on into the indefinite future. But this is a mistake. Many people do, of course, have an intense desire to have children, and many have a very strong desire to have grandchildren. Some people, though fewer, I think, have a strong desire that their own line of descent should continue indefinitely into the future. But the concern that the chain of human generations should extend into the future is not a concern that some particular line of individual descent should persist. The two desires are not mutually exclusive, of course, but the one does not reduce to the other. Dismay at the prospect of humanity's imminent extinction would not be limited to those who have or expect to have children. So it's not only those who have or expect to have children to whom the fate of future generations matters. As I've indicated, our concern for future generations is not a concern that we as individuals should be remembered by those who come after us. That too is a desire that some people have, although in most cases it's primarily a desire to be remembered by some of the people one knew personally. And since those people will themselves exist only for a limited time, the temporal scope of the desire is relatively modest. There are some people who hope to be remembered into the further future for their achievements, but they are many fewer in number, and in even fewer cases is the hope at all realistic. But these hopes and desires, whether more or less modest, are independent of the concern I'm describing, which is a concern that humanity should survive and flourish, and not a concern that one should oneself be remembered. Similarly, the concern for future generations does not consist in or reduce to a desire to have some impact on the lives of one's successors. Again, many people do hope to do something during their own lifetimes that will have some positive impact on those who come after them. But the concern for future generations does not reduce to a hope or a wish of this kind, still less to a hope or a wish that future generations should survive in order that one may have a positive impact on their lives. Our concern for future generations is at once more straightforward and apparently more mysterious. It's straightforward because it's simply a concern that the chain of human generations should be extended into the indefinite future under conditions conducive to human flourishing. What makes this concern seem mysterious is what I've called our temporal parochialism. Most of us lack any clear or well-developed conception of the value of human continuity or of the values that we hope will be realized in the future. Nor do we exhibit any normatively articulate understanding of the importance to us of future generations or of our own relations to them. If I'm right, though, our concern for future generations gives the lie to, or at any rate shows the limits of, our temporal parochialism. When, in imagination, we contemplate the imminent disappearance of the human race, and when we react to that prospect with feelings of loss and sadness and even despair, we make it clear that, despite our tendency to overlook the fact, the survival of human beings matters deeply to us. The point can be put more strongly. If we say, following Harry Frankfurt, that love consists in a disinterested concern for the flourishing of what is loved, then in experiencing such reactions, what we reveal is our love of humanity. This may seem preposterous. How can we be said to love people whose identities are unknown, who don't yet exist, who may never in fact exist, and who, if they do exist, won't do so until after we're dead? How can it even be said that we're concerned about these non-existent people, or that they matter to us, or that they matter to us? Surely the indeterminacy of their identities and our uncertainty about whether they will ever exist are incompatible with attitudes like love and concern. But this is a mistake. To be sure, the love of humanity differs from the love of the particular people we know, just as a love of literature differs from the love of one's dog. Love varies as its objects vary. Our love of humanity comprehends a range of attitudes and dispositions. These include a deep desire that the chain of human generations should extend into the indefinite future under conditions conducive to human flourishing, and a disposition to emotions like profound sadness at the prospect of humanity's imminent disappearance. None of these desires or dispositions is rendered irrational or inappropriate by our lack of knowledge of the identities of the particular people who will live in the future, or even by uncertainty about whether they will exist at all. The suggestion that we exhibit a love of humanity may strike some people as preposterous for a different reason. Even though I've not suggested that this form of love is universal, but only that it's very widespread, it may seem that in order to refute the suggestion, one has only to read the newspaper, any newspaper, anywhere in the world, on any given day. The ongoing record of human savagery, brutality, and violence is so overwhelming, and these tendencies of human behavior manifest themselves with such depressing frequency and on such a staggering scale, that one would have to be mad to propose that a love of humanity is a significant feature of human psychology. Yet the reality of the one does not undermine the reality of the other, any more than the prevalence of cruelty undermines the reality of kindness, or the prevalence of greed undermines the reality of generosity. In suggesting that many people would react to the prospect of imminent human extinction with sadness and even despair, and that these attitudes reveal a form of concern that might best be described as a love of humanity, I'm not suggesting that this concern is our only concern, or our strongest concern, or a concern that coheres smoothly with every other aspect of our psychologies. The complexity of human attitudes and motivations is their most striking feature, which is why every simplifying and reductive theory of human psychology inevitably ends in failure. We human beings are a strange and wondrous and terrible species. Our motives are nothing if not mixed. What I've called the love of humanity is simply part of the mix. The love of humanity should not be confused with the motive of sympathy, which plays such a central role in utilitarian moral psychology. Sympathy, as utilitarians understand it, is a disposition to identify with the pleasures and pains of others, and an ideally sympathetic spectator, as conceptualized by utilitarian theorists, would identify equally with all of the individuals affected by a given act or institution. By contrast, the love of humanity, as I've defined it, includes a desire that the chain of human generations should extend into the indefinite future under conditions conducive to human flourishing. This desire is not equivalent to a form of idealized sympathy, and although the practical implications of the two motives will sometimes coincide, this will not always be the case. Some people may think that the love of humanity is reducible not to sympathy, but rather to self-interest. They may suggest that what I've called reasons of concern, or what we might instead call reasons of love, are themselves self-interested reasons. They're reasons to care about future generations only because future generations matter to us. But this is specious. One might just as well say that our reasons for acting in behalf of the particular people we love, or for concerning ourselves with their well-being, are self-interested, since we have such reasons only because these people matter to us. This is a mistake, albeit a common one, for it neglects the distinction between the interests of a self and an interest in oneself. When we're distressed because someone we love has been harmed, or because something we value greatly has been damaged or destroyed, the fact that it is we who care about the person or value the thing does not make our distress self-interested. To say that we're self-interested is to say something about what we take an interest in, namely ourselves. It's not to say that it is we who take an interest. There's another suggestion about the relation between reasons of love and self-interested reasons that's more plausible. The real significance of our reaction to the prospect of humanity's imminent extinction, it may be said, is that it reveals the superficiality of the distinction between these two types of reason. When we reflect carefully about our reaction to the prospect of humanity's destruction, we come to realize two complementary things. The first is that, because we implicitly understand our own lives as situated at a particular location within a temporally ordered succession of human lives, a threat to the survival of that order is also a threat to us and to the significance of our lives. So insofar as we take a genuine interest in the quality and significance of our lives, that interest must itself encompass a concern for the lives of our successors. The second is that our profound sadness and sense of loss in the face of humanity's imminent destruction registers in part as a shock to ourselves, as an assault on our understanding of our own place in the world. So insofar as we're genuinely concerned with the fate of future generations, insofar as we exhibit a real love of humanity, our love and concern must themselves encompass a recognition of the damage that's done to us when humanity is destroyed. If these observations are correct, then it's a mistake to treat reasons of interest and reasons of love as two separate categories. The real force of the considerations I've been discussing is to show how artificial that distinction is. Properly understood, our interest in ourselves and our concern for what happens to our successors are inseparable. Self-interest and the love of humanity cannot be so neatly pried apart. There's much truth in this line of thought, but it doesn't deprive the distinction between reasons of interest and reasons of love of all its value. Notwithstanding the deep interconnections between our interest in ourselves, as we may come to understand it upon reflection, and our concern for what happens to our successors, we can still distinguish between the fact that the imminent extinction of humanity would evoke in us a profound sense of loss and the fact that it would render many of our own activities pointless. And it's important to see that the first fact is not explained by, but rather explains the second. Since the distinction between reasons of love and reasons of interest provides an effective way of making this point, I'll continue to employ that distinction. So to repeat, we have reasons of at least two different kinds, apart from reasons of beneficence, for concerning ourselves with the fate of future generations, reasons of love and reasons of interest. Reasons of love are rooted in our direct concern for the survival of humanity. Reasons of interest derive from our fundamental interest in leading lives of value here and now, an interest that would be seriously compromised by the prospect of humanity's disappearance. But our reactions to that prospect reveal reasons of another kind as well. For part of the dismay we feel in contemplating the human race's imminent extinction is a response neither to the defeat of our own interests nor to the fate of the humanity we love, but rather to the destruction of value. As I emphasized in Death and the Afterlife, there's a conservative dimension to valuing, something approaching a conceptual connection between valuing something and wanting it to be sustained and to persist over time. In general, we're not indifferent to the destruction of the things that we value. We're not indifferent as between their survival and their disappearance. Admittedly, our conservatism is, as Shauna Shiffrin has pointed out, a complex phenomenon. In some cases, what we want to survive are particular token items that we value: works of art, beautiful buildings, personal relationships. In other cases, what we want to survive are types rather than tokens: wonderful meals, beautiful concerts, thrilling conversations. We don't want individual instances of these types to last forever, but we do want the types to continue to be instantiated. It's also true that we value some things that are essentially ephemeral: bonfires, sandcastles, shooting stars. And our conservatism is in some tension with other attitudes that we hold. In addition to wanting to sustain the things we already value, for example, we also want to create new forms of value and new items of value. We are not only conservative, but also creative creatures, and sometimes our conservative impulses clash with our creative ones. Although, as I'll argue tomorrow, it's an important fact that these two impulses do not always conflict. Yet all of this is by way of qualification rather than refutation. In general, there's a strong connection between valuing something and wanting it to be sustained and preserved over time. This connection helps to explain part of our reaction to the prospect of humanity's disappearance. For part of what is shocking about that prospect is the recognition of how much of what we value will disappear along with the human race. All of the many things we value that consist in or depend on forms of human activity will be lost when human beings become extinct. No more beautiful singing or graceful dancing or intimate friendship or warm family celebrations or hilarious jokes or gestures of kindness or displays of solidarity or much else. Other things that we value, physical artifacts, for example, will survive for a while, but with no one to appreciate their value. For in addition to the disappearance of valuable things, the extinction of the human race will mean the disappearance of valuing from the earth. Whether value can survive without valuing, whether it makes sense to speak of the existence of value in a world where there's nobody left to value anything, is a nice question for philosophers. But for the purpose of understanding our reactions to the prospect of humanity's imminent extinction, the answer doesn't matter very much. When we contemplate that prospect with horror or dismay, part of what we are registering is the disappearance of vast numbers of things that we value, along with the entire known realm of beings with the capacity to appreciate value. And our horror at this prospect points to another reason why the fate of future generations matters to us. It matters to us because, in the respects just mentioned, the future of humanity is the future of value. This means that, in addition to reasons of love and reasons of interest, we have reasons of a third kind, reasons of value, to concern ourselves with the fate of future generations. What is at issue here is neither our direct concern for humanity nor our interest in being able to engage in valued activities during our lifetime. What is at issue is our desire that the things that we value and the very phenomenon of valuing things should survive into the future. I want now to suggest, finally, that we also have reasons of still another kind for taking the interests of future generations seriously, namely, reasons of reciprocity. Let me clarify what I mean by this. When people speak of reciprocity in the intergenerational context, often what they mean is that we have reasons to pay it forward, or to benefit the next generation in the ways that we ourselves were benefited or should have been benefited by the previous generation. This is sometimes described as a principle of reciprocity in an extended sense, or as a principle of indirect reciprocity, or as something that resembles a principle of reciprocity. Consider, for example, Samuel Freeman's remarks when discussing a version of the principle that we should benefit our successors in the same ways that we would have wanted our predecessors to benefit us. Freeman writes, quote, "While this is not a principle of reciprocity, after all, future generations are not able to reciprocate the benefits we bestow on them by bestowing benefits on us, it resembles a principle of reciprocity in that it says, in effect, do unto future generations as you would have previous generations do unto you." End of quote. Now, however plausible that principle may be, it's not what I have in mind when I talk about reasons of reciprocity. I mean instead to be suggesting something that may initially sound much less plausible, namely, that we stand in relations of genuine mutual dependence with future generations, and that it's in virtue of those relations that we have reasons of reciprocity for taking their interests seriously. How can this possibly be? Our relations to future generations seem far too asymmetrical to count as relations of reciprocity. After all, our successors are causally dependent on us. We have the power to affect what happens to them during their lifetimes in profound ways. Indeed, we have the power to determine whether they'll live at all. It's not just that we have the power to affect how many of them will live and what quality of life those who live will enjoy. More radically, we have the power to determine whether human life itself will continue. By contrast, we're not causally dependent on our successors in these same ways. If and when they come into existence, they will not be able retroactively to determine whether we have lived or to exert a causal influence on what happened to us during our lifetimes. Yet if what I said earlier is correct, it would be a mistake to suppose that we're not dependent on them in any way. It would be a mistake not merely because they may be able to bring about the posthumous satisfaction of our desires, although that's an important point, but also because our confidence in the value of our current activities implicitly depends on our confidence in their survival. We are, in this sense, evaluatively dependent on them. And we're emotionally dependent on them as well, inasmuch as the prospect of humanity's imminent disappearance would be profoundly distressing to us. This means that there's a distinctive kind of mutual dependence that characterizes our relations with future generations. On the one hand, the quality of their lives and their very existence are causally dependent on what we do. On the other hand, we are evaluatively and emotionally dependent on them and their survival. In view of this mutual dependence, there's room for a certain idea of reciprocity, which I'll call evaluative reciprocity, to govern our relations to future generations. The prospect of their survival is a precondition for, and so contributes to, our being able to lead lives structured by wholehearted engagement in valued activities. At the same time, there are many different ways in which we can enhance their ability to lead good lives in the future. Because of these reciprocal relations, we have reasons of reciprocity which go beyond the reasons of love, interest, and value already discussed to concern ourselves with their fate. But what exactly is meant by saying that the prospect of their survival is a precondition for our being able to lead value-structured lives? There are two sides to this idea. First, it means that our belief in their survival is a causal precondition of our leading such lives. But second, it means that we see their survival itself as providing us with reasons for confidence in the value of our activities. It's the fact of their survival that's taken to be reason-giving, not our belief in that fact. If we knew that they would not survive, then the prospect of taking a drug that would induce in us a false belief in their survival would be small consolation. This is important because the suggestion that an idea of reciprocity applies to our relations to future generations may seem like a non-starter if we assume, as Samuel Freeman implicitly does in the passage I quoted, that in a relationship of reciprocity, the reciprocal contribution of each party to the other must be understood in terms of the causal effects that each has on the life of the other. Clearly, generations who exist at some future time cannot make causal contributions to our well-being now. At most, it's the prospect of their existence, which is to say our belief that they will exist, that can make such contributions. However, the idea of evaluative reciprocity as applied to the case of future generations asserts something different. It asserts that, on the one hand, we can causally enhance the ability of future generations to lead good and worthwhile lives. But on the other hand, their survival enhances in a different way our ability to lead lives of purpose and value. Their most important contribution to us is not causal, but rational, because their survival provides us with reasons for confidence in the value of many of our activities. As I've argued, this is what we ourselves believe, since if we thought they would not survive, we would see less reason to engage in many of the activities that we now value deeply. Nevertheless, in view of the asymmetrical causal relations between us and future generations, some will continue to doubt whether what I have described is really a form of reciprocity. They'll want to assert just what I'm denying, namely, that in order for talk of reciprocity to be appropriate in this context, future generations would have to make some causal contribution to the quality of our lives. At first glance, this may seem like a mere terminological disagreement, a dispute about how the word reciprocity is to be used. But there's more at stake here than a clash of terminological stipulations. The term reciprocity is appropriate in this context because our relation to future generations is one of genuine mutual dependence, even if the form taken by our dependence on them is different from the form taken by their dependence on us. Each side is dependent on, and so is vulnerable to, what the other does or what happens to the other. This makes it appropriate to speak of a relationship of reciprocity between them. This terminology is appropriate for another reason as well. My primary aim in this lecture is to consider what reasons we have for concerning ourselves with the fate of future generations, but much of the interest of that theoretical question derives from its connection to the practical question of what might actually motivate us to address the serious threats now facing our descendants. As a general matter, reasons of reciprocity are often seen as a particularly powerful source of motivation. In A Theory of Justice, for example, John Rawls argues that there's a deep human tendency to reciprocate the love of others and the concern they display for one's well-being, and that this tendency plays a crucial developmental role in the long process that leads, under favorable conditions, to the eventual emergence in adult human beings of mature moral motivation. Rawls's arguments against utilitarianism importantly depend on the idea that his principles of justice are themselves reciprocity principles, which is to say that they embody an idea of reciprocity in their content. As such, they can draw on sources of motivation that are especially powerful and robust, in part because they're psychologically continuous with the developmentally most primitive forms of moral motivation. By contrast to the utilitarian reliance on sympathy as the primary basis for compliance, he maintains, his principles can appeal to the more stable and secure motive of reciprocity. In using the phrase evaluative reciprocity to characterize our relations with future generations, I mean to be suggesting that people who were sensitive to reasons of reciprocity of the usual kind would see reasons of a recognizably similar kind as applying to our relations with future generations, provided they understood the kind of mutual dependence that characterizes those relations. The fact that people do not already acknowledge such reasons is not decisive evidence against this suggestion. It may show nothing more than that we have not yet been faced with the prospect of humanity's imminent extinction. Even people who, in their more reflective moments, harbor serious doubts about the future of humanity, nevertheless tend to assume, in the way they actually conduct their lives, that human beings will continue to inhabit the earth for an indefinite period of time. Having taken the survival of humanity for granted on a visceral, if not an intellectual level, we may never have had occasion to recognize how much it matters to us or how much we depend on it to support our confidence in the value of our own activities. So my use of the term evaluative reciprocity rests on a conjecture that is at once psychological and conceptual. It rests on the conjecture that if people who were generally susceptible to considerations of reciprocity were to recognize the kind of mutual dependence that characterizes our relation to future generations, they would see those relations as giving rise to reasons for action in virtue of that mutual dependence. In other words, evaluative reciprocity would strike them as a kind of reciprocity. This is not a linguistic point. It doesn't mean that they'd use the word reciprocity to characterize these perceived reasons for action. They might or might not. It means instead that considerations of evaluative reciprocity would engage the same motivational tendencies in them as considerations of ordinary causal reciprocity. It's this psychological and conceptual conjecture that underlies my use of the term evaluative reciprocity and renders it more than a metaphor or mere terminological stipulation. My suggestion, then, is that an idea of evaluative reciprocity governs our relations to future generations, and that in consequence we have reasons of reciprocity to try to secure their survival and flourishing. It may seem that this suggestion gives rise to a version of Derek Parfit's non-identity problem. In general, the non-identity problem arises when some action of ours seems wrong because of its effects on the lives of people in the future, and yet the particular people who are affected by that action would not even have existed if we had acted otherwise. since their lives would not have gone better if we had refrained from the putatively objectionable action, how can that action be said to have wronged them? And if it did not wrong them, then why was it morally objectionable? A version of this problem may seem to apply to reasons of reciprocity as I've described them. For suppose we decide to ignore those purported reasons, and that in consequence, the quality of our successors' lives is much lower than the quality of our successors' lives would have been if we had not ignored those reasons and had acted otherwise. Yet if we had acted otherwise, our successors would have been different people, or so we may suppose. The particular people who in fact succeed us would not even have existed if we had not ignored our reasons of reciprocity. Since their lives would not have gone better if we had acted differently, how can what we have done be morally wrong? But in the first place, I've not said that what we do if we disregard our reasons of reciprocity is morally wrong. Although, as I noted in my remarks about Rawls, reciprocity is often seen as having an important role to play in moral motivation, I have not characterized the reasons of reciprocity I've been discussing as moral reasons, nor have I made any claim about the moral wrongness of disregarding those reasons. What I've characterized as reasons of reciprocity are reasons to try to secure the survival and flourishing of future generations. We have these reasons in virtue of the fact that their survival and flourishing give us reasons for confidence in the value of many of our activities. As I've already indicated, and as I'll explain in greater detail in just a moment, it makes no difference to my argument whether we classify these reasons or any of the other reasons I've been discussing in this lecture as moral reasons or not. What is important is simply that they are reasons with genuine normative force. And as far as the non-identity problem is concerned, the pertinent point is that neither the reasons for confidence that future generations give us, nor our reciprocal reasons to try to ensure their survival and flourishing, are dependent on the identities of the specific individuals who constitute those generations. So the fact that our failure to act on reasons of reciprocity will result in different people being born is irrelevant. If we fail to act on those reasons, then we will not have tried to secure the survival and flourishing of future generations. We will not, in other words, have taken steps to ensure that each generation of human beings is succeeded by another generation whose circumstances are conducive to human flourishing. And that is what we have reason to do. If I'm right, then we have, apart from reasons of beneficence, reasons of at least four additional kinds to concern ourselves with the fate of future generations: reasons of love, interest, value, and reciprocity. As I said at the beginning of the lecture, I don't suppose that everyone has these reasons, only that many people do. Nor do I claim that these reasons are exhaustive. Perhaps we have reasons of other kinds as well. But reasons of these four kinds belong to our collective repertoire of reasons. They're among the reasons that we, the living, have for seeking to secure the survival and flourishing of our descendants. In yesterday's lecture, I called attention to three limitations of the beneficence-based literature on problems of future generations. First, it encourages an overly moralized way of thinking about our relations to our successors and makes it easier to neglect the broader evaluative significance that we attach to human survival and continuity. Second, even within the territory of morality, its preoccupation with duties of beneficence is unduly limiting and leads to a disproportionate emphasis on the puzzles of population ethics. This narrows the focus of moral reflection and makes it easier to avoid asking whether there are other moral values and principles that have a bearing on our relations to our descendants. Third, because of the extent to which beneficence-based duties, as understood by those in the utilitarian tradition, must rely on sympathy to motivate compliance, the beneficence-based literature provides little reason for optimism about the practical and especially the political prospects of effective action aimed at securing the survival of future generations. Although I've expressed reservations about the role that a broadly utilitarian principle of beneficence should be expected to play in thinking about our responsibilities toward future generations, I don't mean to insist that reasons of beneficence have no role at all. The additional types of reason I've cited complement rather than exclude whatever reasons of beneficence there may be. And reflection on those additional reasons may help to overcome the three limitations of an exclusively beneficence-based approach. Let me briefly explain how. First, I've not made any attempt to classify the reasons I've identified either as moral or as non-moral, nor have I drawn any conclusions couched in the language of moral duty. This may seem at first like a peculiarity of my discussion. Surely, it may seem, we have moral obligations to our descendants, and that's the most obvious reason for concerning ourselves with their fates. But I've avoided couching my discussion in moral terms for two complementary reasons. On the one hand, the nature and extent of our moral obligations to our descendants is far from clear. Utilitarian accounts of those obligations are implausible, and non-utilitarian accounts are underdeveloped. On the other hand, if we focus too single-mindedly on questions of obligation, we may fail to notice the remarkable diversity of reasons we have for caring about what happens to our descendants. We may create the impression, or reinforce it where it already exists, that the only reason we have for taking an interest in their fate is so that we can discharge our moral responsibilities. My aim in this lecture has been to undercut this impression and to demonstrate that we have a whole set of reasons to care about future generations. For the purposes of this discussion, what matters is not whether these reasons are moral or non-moral, but whether they're humanly recognizable and whether their normative force is clear. The pertinent point, the point I find illuminating and compelling, is that once we realize how much the future of humanity already matters to us, we can see that we possess reasons of a variety of kinds to help ensure the survival and flourishing of those who come after us. Perhaps some of these reasons should themselves be classified as moral reasons, or perhaps we have moral reasons in addition to those I have canvassed. Given the aims of this discussion, it's not necessary to arrive at a settled assessment of these possibilities, and so I'll simply set them aside. Second, since the reasons I've described are all independent of reasons of beneficence, they have no tendency to narrow the focus of investigation in the way that the beneficence-based literature does. Rather than directing our attention to the puzzles of population ethics in particular, they invite us to reflect in a more open-ended way about how the diverse considerations they exemplify might best be expressed in our actions and in the ways we choose to live. Finally, there remains the question of how practical political solutions might be found to the problems that threaten future generations. The four reasons I've described do not, of course, answer that question. They don't demonstrate what shape a politics of the future might take. But they do demonstrate that such a politics need not be left wholly at the mercy of the uncertain motivational power of sympathy. The reasons I've described, reasons of love, interest, value, and reciprocity, all have the potential to motivate action aimed at securing the survival and flourishing of future generations. What are needed are effective programs and strategies to achieve those aims. Of course, the task of creating such programs and strategies is bound to be challenging. But the task is made needlessly difficult if we assume that utilitarian sympathy is the only motive that might be available to sustain any practical initiatives we undertake. Once we free ourselves from that assumption, we can see that, although the task of constructing an effective politics of the future represents a formidable challenge, there's no shortage of reasons or motives available to support such a politics. Insofar as there's a deficit that must be overcome if we're seriously to address the threats facing future generations, the deficit is as much political as it is motivational. Still, the conclusions for which I've argued today may seem disappointing when viewed through the lens of the beneficence-based literature on future generations. Rather than offering an alternative principle or set of principles that might play a role comparable to that of a principle of beneficence, all I've done is to identify reasons why we should be concerned about the survival and flourishing of future generations. This, it may seem, stops well short of offering us detailed guidance, or indeed any guidance, about how we should act where the interests of future generations are at stake. As I've argued, however, I think it would be a mistake to treat the quest for a principle of beneficence as dictating the form that our thinking about future generations should take. It bears repeating that no plausible principle of beneficence has yet been identified, and that for non-utilitarians, it's not clear that such a principle is wanted or needed. Moreover, although a principle of beneficence is meant to have very wide application, the quest for such a principle has actually had the unfortunate effect of narrowing the discussion of future generations to a small number of issues. It has focused attention on the puzzles of population ethics to the neglect of other questions and on beneficence to the neglect of other values. It has tried to solve the puzzles with which it has been preoccupied by identifying a very general principle of beneficence that can accommodate a small number of intuitive fixed points, and its most striking contribution has been to show how difficult it is to do this. And in a puzzle-loving discipline like philosophy, this very difficulty has only attracted more attention to the quest for solutions and has discouraged people from considering a wider set of questions about the importance to us of the human future. It's true that I have not proposed a master principle with the breathtaking scope of Derek Parfit's theory X, which is supposed to have acceptable implications when applied to all of the choices that we ever make, including those that affect both the identities and number of future people. On the one hand, as I said yesterday, I don't think it's clear that we should expect to find such a principle. On the other hand, it's not true that my conclusions provide no normative guidance at all. I've maintained that we have strong reasons of at least four different kinds to want the chain of human generations to continue into the indefinite future under conditions conducive to human flourishing. Our reasons to want these things are also reasons to try to secure them, to do what we can, granted our limited knowledge and the fact that we face great uncertainty of many different sorts, to ensure that future generations will survive for the indefinite future and will be able to live in reasonably favorable circumstances. This does not amount to a comprehensive principle of right action, but it articulates a regulative ideal that draws on values of a number of different kinds and sets a standard of adequacy or sufficiency with clear normative significance. To say that the standard has normative significance is to say that we can violate it and that we can recognize violations of it. And we do violate it when, for example, we engage in patterns of activity that threaten to render the Earth uninhabitable for human beings by the end of this century or the next one. To my mind, the fact that such activity violates this standard provides a compelling explanation of what's objectionable about it, and it's an explanation that's not dependent on a successful conclusion to the search for a satisfactory principle of beneficence or for Parfit's theory X. Nor is this explanation dependent on a highly moralized understanding of ourselves or our place in the world. The standard I've articulated is supported not in the first instance by an argument for moral duty or obligation, but by reasons of love, interest, value, and reciprocity. These reasons speak to a diverse and widely shared array of human motivations. It's not only the morally heroic or the morally fastidious or the morally sensitive who have reasons to concern themselves with the fate of future generations or who can be expected under the right conditions to be motivated by the reasons that speak in favor of such concern. The practical significance of this fact is evident, but it also bears on the issues that I raised at the beginning of yesterday's lecture. My starting point then was the observation that most of us lack a rich set of evaluative resources for thinking about the value of human continuity. We don't have a confident and normatively articulate understanding of our place in time or of the significance of our relations to people living at other times. The considerations I've been rehearsing in this lecture do not contradict these observations, but they do help to explain why many people experience the poverty of our evaluative thought about the future as a form of privation, and why they have an inchoate sense that other generations matter to us in ways that we can't easily explain. Of course, the considerations I've been discussing do not by themselves remedy the deficiencies in our evaluative thought to which I've called attention. They don't supply us with a fully developed repertoire of ideas about the significance of our place in the succession of generations. No mere philosophy lecture could do that. Such ideas would instead have to emerge from and be supported by much wider tendencies of thought in our culture. Who knows whether that will happen? What I've tried to do in this lecture is something much more modest. I've tried to show that we should not take our apparent temporal parochialism at face value. We should not suppose that we lack any impulse to find evaluative significance in our relations to our ancestors and descendants, or that we're simply indifferent to the fate of future generations. Even in the absence of a shared understanding of the evaluative significance of our place in time, and despite our depressing record of inaction in the face of climate change and other grave threats to human survival, the structure of our own values, when considered carefully, turns out to presuppose the importance to us of human continuity and of the persistence of human generations into the future. Whatever the potential practical significance of this fact may be, it also has implications for our understanding of ourselves and our values. It means that if we want to think further about the importance to us of our place in the chain of in the chain of generations, the starting point of such reflection, the default setting from which we begin, should not be the assumption of indifference. We already care about our place in time and about the survival of future generations. We just need to allow ourselves to acknowledge that this is so, and then we need to do our best to draw the appropriate practical conclusions. In tomorrow's lecture, I'll attempt to situate our attitudes toward future generations within a broader framework. I'll consider how those attitudes fit within the context of the more general relations between our valuing attitudes as a whole and our attitudes toward time. Thank you.